to Dayanov, Mike, President Biden is pushing through an aggressive plan to allow 11 million undocumented immigrants to become citizens. It's a move that many welcome, but those on the right are opposed. We talked to one local professor on what this may mean for those living in the shadows locally and nationally. We talk about African-American contributions to Major League Baseball and the White Sox and Cubs, and how historic was this snow we got? We talked to a legendary Chicago weatherman. And it's cold outside, but sports are heating up. All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lynx Republic Radio. I'm Michael Puente. President Biden is moving to create a path to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States and increase DACA protections for those individuals who were brought to this country illegally as a child by their parents. Biden is also reversing former President Donald Trump's policy that kept asylum seekers to wait in Mexico for a decision. Asylum seekers will now be allowed to stay in the United States as their case is pending, which had been the long-standing rule in the United States and across the world. Republicans are already pushing back on this plan. For example, Indiana U.S. Senator Mike Braun says Biden's move shows he is not tough on immigration and rewards those who broke the law. Joining me to talk about these moves is Indiana University Northwest professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs, Joe Gomez Daigle. Joe, welcome to Off Mic.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for the invite. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak about this issue. It's very close to my heart.
No problem, Joe. And, you know, earlier this week, Indiana University played host to a conference talking about immigration issues nationally and how it affects Northwest Indiana. Joe, right now, what are some of your more immediate takes on what President Biden is trying to do?
First of all, I feel very strong that they're making moves to try to correct the problem that has not been addressed for many, many years. And it's going to provide a citizenship for many immigrants who are still in the United States. And I'm going to say this not only for the Latinos, for everyone, okay? So every nationality that's out here. The unfortunate part is that the majority of these individuals who are immigrants, whether came here legally or not legally, when I'm saying legally, we have to be careful about that, because we tend to think that people from outside this country should know our rules right away before they walk in. We don't even know the rules outside of our country, so that tends to be a problem. Well, the point is that when they come in, they're afraid. There is a fright with many of these immigrants that they don't want to speak up. They don't want to say anything on the fear of deportation, on the fear that they may be stigmatized right away by community, such as like what the state senators just said here. And that is totally, and I'm going to say this, I hope it's totally ignorant that for people to start to think that way. Their parents came in a fashion that they might have forgotten. And I'm an immigrant. I came here from Mexico when I was 9 years old, not knowing a word of English. We had our papers, everything was right, but there was still fear that if we spoke up, if we did something wrong, we may be deported. And that's where many of the immigrants get hurt. That's the topics that we touched on through Indiana University SPIA program that they had called immigration that we need to talk about.
Let me ask you something, Joe. Over the last 4 years when President Trump was in office, not getting into a lot of the politics, but a lot of his rhetoric, and some Hispanics may disagree whether they were disparaging or racist against Hispanics, but by and large, I think at least 75% of Hispanics kind of feel that a lot of his language was disparaging against Hispanics. How do you think the environment or the atmosphere around Latinos, especially those who may be undocumented, how did things change for them in the United States?
Well, during that era, during those 4 years, there was a backlash against Latinos, first of all, because of that rhetoric that we haven't heard of for many, many, many years. And that hurt the Latinos or the talented people that came in or whatever, any individual that wanted to come here to the country to look at a better lifestyle that they've had, whether they were through immigration or through because they needed to flee their government because there were problems in their government. So that discouraged many of them, and they didn't find the trust, what we used to have in this country, trust in our government and in the good old Lady Liberty. So it was discouraging. And so, but we have to address that too. We have to recognize that that's not all of Americans. That is not all of Americans. I would tend to say that it's about 15 to 20% of those Americans that are downright, they're very passionate about protecting their ignorance, and they're not well informed. I hate to say it that way, because when you deal with students in college and we're trying to teach them how to be able to have a decent dialogue, not a discussion, but because discussions are like concussions. When I talk to them, I try to let them know, don't internalize things. Let's try to pinpoint the problem and identify the causes of the problem. And from there, set objectives. And right off the start, when about 4 years ago, and the Republican Party has that mentality that it still carries on, they still have that. They don't want to pinpoint the problem. They don't want to identify the causes, and they don't want to set objectives to improve our communities. The Japanese have a good word called Kaizen, continuous improvement. But I think these people are still stuck in their, I'm an American. Now, wait a second. American is a nice, diversified community like Northwest Indiana. And it's just, it's troubling, but it's hurting, but that's life. And I'm saying that's life not in a negative way, but not to lose hope. But we need to start to get the young students or the young people to get well-informed, not educated, because let's say Brahm is educated, but he's not well-informed on all the issues to have compassion. That's the problem that we have. So, yes.
Well, Joe, let me ask you this. I mean, you have people like U.S. Senator Mike Braun of Indiana, who's pushing back hard on some of President Biden's initiatives. What do you say to somebody like Mike Braun, who represents all of Indiana, but of course he's from Southern Indiana, probably has never been to Northwest Indiana that I can think of. He's a very strong Republican, very strong supporter of Donald Trump. What does he get wrong in the way he views immigration?
Now we have to address this methodically. Braun is, if he's a Republican, he's a Trump Republican. That doesn't reflect the true Republicans, which are also compassionate. They want to have issues to be solved, whether it's immigration or anything. And Braun is completely on the Trump side, the Trump cult mentality. And that needs to be changed from the general public, from the people out there that say, you know what, that's not the way to do things in America. And so we need to push that kind of mentality off to the side. He may try to be a proponent of that kind of mentality, but the general public is going to come out from, it's exactly just from what happened just recently, the riots in the Capitol, you know, where the man excited a riot, but he says, oh no, but wait until it happens to him. When it happens to him or he gets discriminated, it becomes a totally different issue. And they know how to squirm themselves out of that. That's what I would say, you know, stop and think, be patient. Be patient because your parents were immigrants. Everyone was an immigrant. And if he starts to identify, well, my parents came here illegally, but wait a second, you know, some people did not come here legally. You know, the ocean is wide, Canada's wide open. Why address Mexico, you know? So it's just, we have to set the rules of engagement so that individuals like him have at least a nice way to approach and set objectives to formulate alternatives to fix the problem or to make America a welcoming country. We have a lot of space in this country. Beautiful.
Well, Joe, what do you say to people who may push back on that and say, well, this does reward illegal behavior, and with this, as far as asylum seekers, oh, the United States is now such an attractive, Biden, his policies are making it really attractive for people to come up from Central America to seek asylum. What do you say to people who don't want to see that?
Well, you know, I can't convince them. Like I said, those individuals will be passionate about protecting their ignorance, okay? So we have to say to many other general public that there is a difference between asylum and immigration. Whether immigration comes from on the boat, Haitians from the boat, Cubans, okay? And specifically Cubans, too, who came here, not legally, but they came here because they were fleeing in masses. I saw that. My brother-in-law is a Cuban, but I think he forgot how the struggles were. And that's what we need to let him know. I'll give you an example. I was in Plymouth, Indiana, promoting the census, and a little lady came up to me and she says, I don't have any problem with those people coming to our country. And I know that in Plymouth was predominantly German. And she says, but they got to learn the English language. And I asked her, point blank, I said, did you have a radio station here about 3 years ago that were their music and their programs were all German? And the newspapers were in German? And we had those things in Northwest Indiana, too. And she says, oh, yeah, but we learned. And that learning is a process. So, you know, people forget those things. People just tend to our generations or some people have what we called instant gratification, and they forget pretty easy what tough times, romantic tough times they had, I call it. And once they get something that they worked hard, they forget about where they came from. And that's the immigrants. That's the people that keep America going. And I'm saying it again because I was an immigrant. I didn't know any word of English, but I help anybody who's out there trying to come to America. Isn't it beautiful to see some people come to America? There's a good book out there that I think some people should try to pick up. It's called The Stars Are Talking. And it's beautiful because it's about an immigrant coming to this country who ends up in the Appalachian Mountains before World War II. And that was a nasty experience for that individual. So we have to recognize where we came from. We have to stop and think, be passionate about it. Walk quietly and try to figure out how we can work together. The Africans have a word called Sobutu, which means we're all in this together, you know? I think some Americans think, you know, I'm different. No, we're all in this country together. We're all a mixing pot that we have so much talent, but yet some people think what's mine is mine. Forget about you now. I got mine. And we have to figure out how we need to help everybody. Immigrants.
Well, Joe Gomez-Dago is a professor in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University Northwest in Gary. Joe, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Thank you very much, Michael.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. It's been more than half a century since Jackie Robinson broke baseball's color barrier. He led the path for others to play in Major League Baseball, including for the White Sox and Cubs. Those early efforts are having an impact on today's players in Major League Baseball. Joining me to talk about this is Steve Zaliski, longtime reporter with the Daily Herald, who also writes a weekly column on the history of baseball in Chicago. Steve, thank you for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me, Mike.
Well, Steve, we're going to touch a little upon, of course, on your column about African Americans who first joined the Chicago White Sox, this being Black History Month. You know, what can you tell us about those first players who joined the Chicago White Sox?
Well, the first players who joined the Sox weren't necessarily the first players who played with the Sox. As everyone probably knows, Minnie Minoso was the first White Sox player, black White Sox player, to take an at-bat, and that would have been May 1st against the 1951 against the New York Yankees. And on the first at-bat, Minnie hit a home run against Yankees pitcher Vic Rashi. However, there were two players at the time in the minor league system who were signed the year before. The very first player to be signed was a man by the name of Sam Hairston. The last name probably sounds very familiar to you. And even today, that name probably sounds familiar to baseball fans of the Los Angeles Dodgers, because a member of the broadcast crew is Jerry Hairston Jr., who played with the Cubs for about a year and a half as well. But Sam Hairston is his grandfather. And Sam Hairston had about a six-year career with the Indianapolis Clowns of the Negro American League. You can see him in a film clip. There's a YouTube clip of some, you might call it workout footage. Goose Tatum, who was a great basketball player with the Harlem Globetrotters, was the main player with the Indianapolis Clowns at the time, and it shows him kind of living up to the team's name. He has a lot of antics in the field involving baseball and acrobatics and funny facial expressions. But the Sox signed Sam Hairston in the middle of the 1950 season, and he was immediately sent to Colorado Springs, one of their minor league affiliates. Now, just within days, the Sox in that 1950 season signed a man by the name of Bob Boyd. Now, Sam was a catcher who played some third base, and Bob Boyd was a first baseman. So they had them both in Colorado Springs. There was a little bit of cloak and dagger involved with Bob Boyd's signing. Boyd was with the Memphis Red Sox, which was owned by a couple of brothers who were doctors. And apparently there had been a little bit of a family feud. And one of the doctors sold Boyd for $15,000 to the Sox or to Colorado, basically. The other brother immediately said that the signing was not authorized. It led to a bit of a legal dispute. One of the brothers, the one who had signed Boyd, shipped him onto a plane in the dead of night so he could arrive in Colorado the next day. And he homered on his first at-bat.
Wow.
So it was a little bit involved, and neither of these guys had even played an inning for the Sox yet.
That's amazing. Let me ask you something, Steve. Why is it important for not just baseball fans, but Americans to remember the contributions of those early African-American players?
Well, I think they were important in the sense that they were pioneers. Played at a time when there was racial discrimination in baseball, when black players were just starting to be accepted onto major league teams. Jackie Robinson was not the first major league black player. You can go back to the 19th century, and I'd have to go back and look up my references, but he was the first in the 20th century, and he had faced a lot of resistance. It was a very bold move by the Brooklyn Dodgers to sign him. There had been a lot of talk of having African-American players on Major League Baseball teams, and it was a very difficult sell for a lot of owners. And once Jackie Robinson was signed and came up with the Dodgers, life was not easy for him or for the people who played after him. So they, you know, they proved themselves and they really paved the way for integration within the major leagues. So they're very important, even if many of them were either at the end of their careers or didn't play very much. I know Sam Hairston with the White Sox had only 5 major league at-bats. He has a 400 batting average lifetime. But he was also important because he was the gateway to future black players on the White Sox. After he had his 5 at-bats in 1951, the Sox sent him down to Colorado Springs again, and he stayed there except for 1 year through 1956. He was stuck in the minor league system as a player. He played 4 more years in the Sox system. Then they had him as a coach, as a scout. You may remember a couple of these names, Carlos May, Lamar Johnson. He signed them. He was the scout who discovered them. And
big names.
Yeah, Bob Boyd, the other gentleman I talked about, he was up and down with the Sox for about 3 years. He played in 1951, 1953. And 1954, the Sox, never a complete season in that time. He did wind up on the Baltimore Orioles in the late 50s, and in fact, he became a regular player for about 3 or 4 years, and he finished 4th in batting in the American League in 1957.
But, hey, Steve, let me ask you this. What do we know about when these players came up to Chicago? We know Chicago was a very segregated city. We know Bridgeport, where the Sox, Comiskey Park was at, wasn't always the most welcoming area for African Americans. But we do know we do know that a lot of African American ballplayers, even those early signings with the Chicago Cubs, actually lived on Chicago's South Side, where more historically African Americans live. Do we know anything about their treatment or how they were received when they came to Chicago?
I do know that, you know, the Sox were about 3 years late as far as signing African American players. The first Sox player was Minnie Minoso. That was 4 years after Jackie Robinson came to the Dodgers. The Cubs didn't sign their first black players until a couple of years later, and then Ernie Banks and Gene Baker came up. I think they were accepted by the fans. I don't think that they really advanced the cause of treatment of blacks within, say, areas like housing or schooling in Chicago in the 50s or the 60s. I know that some players found it hard to get a house in, you know, white areas like Geneva. I can double check that, but I'm pretty sure that was the town where Ernie Banks, who was established at the time, tried to get a home and couldn't. So the cause of social justice was not terribly advanced within the city, which remained quite polarized racially in the 50s and 60s. And in fact, there were riots in Chicago in the late 60s over issues of discrimination. And at that time, both teams in Chicago were fairly well integrated. But even there, the Cubs, it is said, traded Lou Brock because there were too many black players on the team. That's just a rumor. And one that was advanced by the first black coach on the Cubs, who was Buck O'Neill, who said he had heard that about Brock. So it was a good thing, you know, to have the teams integrated. But I think Chicago still wrestles with issues of race, and I'm not sure that what was happening on the field influenced much what was happening off the field.
You know, I find it interesting that the first player to be considered the Chicago's White Sox, first African-American player, actually first black player and first Hispanic player, right, is Minnie Minoso. That he sort of emulates both of them because he's both Latino and he's both African-American. And right, we come to the modern age where we're hearing that African-American participation in Major League Baseball is down. We are coming up what could be a historic season for the White Sox, that as they try to build upon their success so far. And we have on the White Sox team, Tim Anderson, one of the most outspoken African-American and dynamic players in Major League Baseball on the team. He's also very socially conscious. Right. What does this time mean for the White Sox? This moment for the team, not only success, but in the larger context, with all the racial division we have in our country now, it's Black History Month, but also linking it to the past.
Well, I think that Tim Anderson's a very important voice, for social justice, and I think he's an influence within the clubhouse. You see that with, you know, Lucas Giolito and the bonding that has occurred there. I think that his success could cause, could be influential, interesting more, African-American players, to want to play Major League Baseball. I think that, the Sox as well, are involved in the community. I know that their ACES program serves as a pipeline for a lot of African-American players, and not only to play baseball, but, to get a college education. So I think that, there's some very important work, being done there on the South Side.
Well, Steve, your columns about the Chicago White Sox and history, and certainly this one about its first African-American ball players, really resonated. So, Steve, thank you so much for joining us today on Off Mic.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. You know, there are these debates on the GOAT, the greatest of all time, Michael Jordan or LeBron James in basketball, or Joe Montana versus Tom Brady in the NFL. What about the greatest of all time in terms of snowstorms in the Chicago area? How did this week's storms rank with the greats of the past? There's only one person to ask this question, longtime WGN weatherman Tom Skilling. Tom, welcome to Off Mic. How significant was this snowfall from the past couple of weeks?
Well, it's pretty interesting. We've had at Midway Airport over 40 inches of snow total in the last 2 weeks. That's more snow than normally comes down in an entire season around here. And what's interesting is everybody knows, the scenes that we're seeing now are reminiscent of what we used to see in those barbaric winters of the 70s, in particular the late 70s. Mike, we had 26 inches of snow on the ground yesterday at Midway Airport. That was just 3 inches shy of the heaviest snow cover we've ever had here in Chicago. And the last time it was recorded was over 40 years ago. Back in February of 1979, we had 29 inches of snow on the ground at that time, so we were just 3 inches below that. But it's really incredible. We've kind of compressed all this horrible winter weather into the past 2 weeks because we had had a very mild winter going up to that point. And now, here as we move into through the 13th day of Arctic cold, the snows, of course, have turned on, and we've compressed so much of our snow. We had a snow drought going at one point. We've certainly gotten out of that. We're now way above normal on snowfall, and we've got roofs collapsing and everything else. It's kind of a mess out there.
Tom, let me ask you this. How does the lake effect snow factor in? Because I just saw heard a report that, well, the lake effect snow has now moved out, but the lake is still there. So isn't there a potential for more lake effect snow?
Oh, yeah. Don't write this winter off yet. We do have a nice warm-up coming next week. The snow cover will retard that some, but we're still expecting every day next week to be above freezing. And then you'll get a freeze up at night and, we'll thaw again the following day. And that'll go on all week long. But don't write off additional snow yet. That can still happen. With regard to lake effect, we often think of most of the lake effect occurring on the other side of the lake. But we had this unique setup where the air was bitterly cold. And that's an important ingredient in producing lake snow because you want your temperature to drop from the lake surface to a mile up by at least 20 degrees, and it was dropping more like 30 to 40 degrees in this cold air. That encourages the air to rise, and then the moisture from the lake goes up with that rising air and makes your lake effect clouds. And if you can sustain a north-northeast wind down the length of the lake, then you got a lot of time for that wind to pick up moisture, and you can really dump some impressive snows. And the interesting thing about our snowstorm this week was that it was concentrated in the counties closest to the lake. We had close to 18 inches at Evanston and also down at Midway Airport. 17.7 was the official total Midway. And yet when you moved out to O'Hare, in the city but on the other side of the city, they only got 7.8 inches. And by the time you moved out to Aurora, it was down to 2.8 inches out in the Fox Valley. And DeKalb and Belvedere only had 1.7 inches. So it shows how much snow that that lake effect added to the snowfall that we had around here.
Now, this latest pattern, is this something that you predicted or you saw coming just a week or so ago?
Oh, yes, yes. You know what happened? We were, and I say we in the meteorological profession, I had an alumni phone call with my friends at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Atmospheric Sciences Department. That was just a couple weeks ago, and we were marveling at the total lack of cold air across North America. I don't think we've ever seen so much of the continent so warm. It was all the cold air was on the other side of the planet over in Siberia and Russia. Well, in late January, the cold air started crossing the poles, something our models had accurately predicted. So the cold air comes diving from Canada into the U.S. And then warm air in the Arctic aloft produced this incredible and very strange blocking pattern, which hemmed this cold air in across North America. And that's part of the reason they've been having such trouble down south. The cold air was expansive, but because it was locked in by a blocking pattern for a week to 2 weeks' time, the cold air had time to produce snow down there. And when you put snow on the ground becomes reflective. It doesn't allow the sunlight to heat the warm air, the air mass to warm it. And the result is the cold just lingers and even intensifies. So, this cold air was predicted, started in Siberia in late January, wound up down here. It's parked here for about 2 weeks, and really it's been the only bitterly cold period of the whole winter. We had one cold day back on Christmas. That was it. The winter was quite mild. In fact, December was over 5 degrees above normal. January was more than 5 degrees above normal. And then we got to February 5th. About 2 weeks ago, and bam, the cold air hit, and it's held tight. But the blocking pattern that has trapped it in here is breaking down, so we look for quite a warm-up coming. But we may have another snow Sunday afternoon and night and a couple of little light patches of snow before then, before the warm air really takes hold.
So did Chicago tie a record in terms of consecutive days of significant snowfall?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we put together 9 consecutive days of measurable snow. That ties for the most consecutive days of measurable snow. And another stat, it snowed 11 of the past 13 days here in Chicago. So, wow, we went from a snow drought to almost continuous snow visiting us at one point or another almost every day for the last 2 weeks. which is why the whole change has been so jarring. It's not been not only been unusually cold, but it's been unusually snowy. And we did establish a record there. Now, I think the most interesting stat, Mike, is the fact that at Midway Airport, if you add up all the snows over the last 2 weeks, more than 40 inches of snow came down. An average full winter only gets about 36 inches at Midway Airport. So we had more snow, and we've had more snow in the last 2 weeks than we typically get in a full winter here in the city itself.
Wow, that is interesting. So, Tom, you've been around for a long time. How does this latest snow event compare to, say, 1977? People talk about 1967. How does it rank?
Well, I'll tell you something. We've had some monster snowstorms. I remember the blizzard of 67. I was a paper boy out in the western suburbs, and that snow came down. It followed 60-degree temperatures by 3 days, and that snow stuck around for the next 2 months. Then the 79 blizzards, gosh, we started with a snowstorm in December. We had snowstorms almost every 2 weeks. It culminated in the blizzard of 79, which is the one that knocked Michael Blandick out of office because of the poor job the city had done at removing snow. And Jane Byrne was elected, upsetting the machine candidate in that. And, of course, we had the Groundhog's Day blizzard just 10 years ago. And we had a blizzard in 1999, and we've had some other ones, too. What's been remarkable about this particular spell is how much snow has fallen, how quickly, and how it totally reversed the snow trend that we had set in this for this winter before that. It had been unusually warm, unusually unsnowy. In fact, we had what could only be described as a snowdrop going, and all of a sudden, 2 weeks ago, the snow turned on, and it hasn't turned off since. So the speed with which we've accumulated snow and the amount of snow we put on the ground has set this aside from a lot of winters, but it hasn't beaten our big snowstorms like the 79 blizzard, the 67 blizzard, or even the Groundhog's Day blizzard 10 years ago. We've had bigger snows. And another thing, those storms had much more wind with them. That was a full-blown blizzard in those storms. This was not a blizzard. It was windy, and there was some blowing of the snow, but it was nothing like those snowstorms in terms of wind.
But it is still pretty significant and still pretty impressive.
Very impressive. Very jarring. No question about it. I mean, the rapidity with which the change took place is what really has set what's gone on in the last 2 weeks aside. I think that really has kind of, from an atmospheric standpoint, kind of smacked us all in the face in a way that not many winters do. It doesn't turn so quickly. And but again, the thing to remember is, you know, this has been two rough weeks. It had been an extraordinarily mild and extraordinarily unsnowy winter up to the time this occurred, and I think that's probably why it's affected us all so much, coming as it has on top of that with the COVID-19 issues we've all been facing and everything else. It's been quite a jarring change.
You did mention Michael Blandick and how sometimes snow can impact politics. How do you think the Lori Lightfoot administration has handled snow removal in the city for this event?
You know, it's interesting. I've been sequestered in my home and working from home, so I've been out. I have not been out driving around. I know my producer, who comes in from Elmhurst, Bill Snyder, told me that boy, that drive in that day was terrible, and that wasn't just Lori Lightfoot's area of jurisdiction. That was IDOT. He travels over a lot of the roads there, but you know, in fairness to the folks who plow our streets, because Streets and Sand does an amazing job most of the time. And I'll tell you, ever since that debacle of a decade we had in the 70s where the snows were coming one after another and we had sub-zero cold spells after that, that was really amazing. You know, in that year, the salt that was being spread on roads was so ineffective that they decided to add calcium chloride to it. to melt the snow at lower temperatures, because the problem in the 70s was you had these mammoth cold waves that came in after each of the snowstorms. We've not had that in recent years. I mean, we've had our snowstorms, but we haven't had, you know, 15 and 20 below zero temperatures right in the wake of that in the city. And so, but they added calcium chloride to the salt mixture, and that's now what's spread on our roads. And therefore, our snow removal folks have that as a tool that really does help.
My last question is, are you worried about a too rapid of a warm-up that would melt a lot of that snow and possibly cause flooding?
Well, you know something, they do what are called cores, our weather observers, and they mentioned even before this last snowstorm, there was more than an inch of water in the snow. And where you get in trouble as you get into the warmer months is if you're melting snow and then you're raining 1 and 2 or 3 inches on top of it, that tends to, you know, send water into our waterways, our rivers and so forth. And also, you get a lot of ice on these rivers and streams that break up when you start warming up. And so you get ice damming on some of the rivers that becomes an issue. I think at this point in time, we'll have some melting, and we'll probably, if we get big rains on top of it, that would be an issue. I don't see that happening right now. So I think we're going to be able to eat away at the snowpack next week with this warming coming in and kind of melt a little bit every day. And that ought to control the flooding that might otherwise occur. But on the other hand, you're going to have ice falling off buildings and all, and that always is a hazard here in the city.
Tom Skilling, you're a legend. Thank you so much. I appreciate you speaking with me. That's quick, and a quick response to that. So thank you so much.
Oh, Mike, that's all right. Thanks. Call anytime. I'm happy to help.
And we'll be back with more Off Mike. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lake Shore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Okay, it's about 20 degrees in Chicago. Still chilly, but the sun is out. And that may mean baseball is not too far away. Spring training for pitchers and catchers for the White Sox have already started in what could be a run for the World Series later this year. Joining us to talk about the Sox and other sports is veteran sports reporter for WBEZ, Cheryl Ray Stout. Cheryl, welcome back to Off Mic.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. So let's face it, is this year World Series or bust for the White Sox?
Well, that's what the players like Tim Anderson and Lucas Giolito and Rick Hahn and Tony La Russa, the manager, they're all talking about it. They are talking about the World Series. They're in it to win it. And that's great to hear because they do have a lot of pieces, but, you know, you still have to play. They're talking about 162 games this year. I still wonder if they'll ever get all those games in, but that's their goal.
Sure. How excited? I mean, are you having to do extra preparation or anything to cover this team? I mean, we know a few years ago the Cubs were up and coming and they made it to the World Series. Are you preparing for, it's got to be more fun to cover a winning team than, say, a losing one.
Absolutely. You either want the team to be really, really good or really horrible. In between kind of stinks, you know?
Yeah.
But it is difficult because we still have to only do Zoom calls. You know, my natural ability as a reporter is being able to talk to guys one-on-one, you know, away from everybody else to get all those nuggets. So this is kind of, it's sad because we normally would be able to ride the crest wave of something like this, and we won't be able to do it. But I'm telling you, there are some really great stories that are going to develop. Oh, and make sure, if you haven't seen already, look up Yoan Moncada's music video. It's outstanding.
Oh, wow. Does he sing in it?
Yes, he does.
Dance. Oh, my God. Oh, my
look
God.
It up. It is fabulous.
Well, Moncada is one, you know, if you looked, I saw this list recently that the White Sox have the most players in the top 100 mm-hmm. of the top players in baseball of any team in Major League Baseball. That's pretty exciting for this lineup.
Absolutely. You know, and you look at the way, what was interesting talking to Rick Hahn the other day is that, you know, they've filled out their roster. Free agents don't want to come here in regards to because everything is filled. They don't, you know, there's not a lot of needs that they have anymore. So, you know, people were wondering, why didn't they sign this guy? Why didn't they sign that guy? Because the free agent's going, how much time am I going to get? How many games am I going to be able to play? And so that puts them in a good spot. And here's one of the people to watch is going to be Ethan Katz, their new pitching coach. He was a high school coach, pitching coach for Lucas Giolito, was with the Giants organization last year, and he fills Don Cooper's role. And he's already, apparently, from what I'm hearing, he's working magic with Dylan Cease, another guy. So that's something to watch.
Now, what about the Cubs? The Cubs, I know they got Jake Arrieta's returning to the Chicago Cubs.
Yeah.
They're kind of feeling sort of like they're the underdog in Chicago now. They're no longer the big kid on the block, or, you know, maybe they still are.
They kind of remind you what happened in 2014 with them. You know, they have players, and you have three players that are that could walk at the end of the year, Javi Baez, Chris Bryant, and Anthony Rizzo. So the question mark is, will they trade one of these guys or a couple of these guys during the season if things are going south for them? And also, if they don't think that they could sign them. Jake Arrieta, nice guy to have back, but he's at the end of his rope. He had three seasons with Philadelphia, all injury-plagued years. You have no hard-throwing pitchers on this team, for starters. You know, Kyle Hendricks is going to be your ace, and you have Alec Mills, and you have people there that cannot throw in the high 90s, which is pretty much the way it goes in baseball. So they're going to have to be really on their game in order to succeed. And the other thing is, you don't have a Yu Darvish, who was your ace. You traded him away. You don't have John Lester. You don't have Jose Quintana. You don't have Tyler Chatwood. So you pretty much wiped out a lot of your pitching core. So it's going to be really important for David Ross to try to get the most out of these guys. And the back end of the bullpen, he said, David Ross told us the other day that Craig Kimbrell will be his closer. So can he, you know, continue his success that he was having towards the end of last year? Or will he go back to what he was like the year before?
You know, Cheryl, we do know both the Cubs and the White Sox both train in Arizona in the Phoenix area. Do you think there's going to be, I mean, I don't know how much each other, you know, peer into others' camps, but do you feel there may be a little pressure on the Cubs to say, hey, you know, we're probably not as strong as we used to be. The Sox look great. We got to play a little bit harder to just keep up with the White Sox. We don't want to get blown out of the city.
I don't think that it matters to them, because they've always had this solid footing in Chicago with fandom and you know, and the like. But players may start feeling that. The team doesn't. You know, I'm separating the way the team thinks and the way the players think. And the players are going to take notice of what's going on the South Side, no doubt about that. But the arrogance sometimes of ownership doesn't realize that they could be on a downfall. Because think about this. There's not going to be fans right away at Wrigley and at Sox Park. So there's not going to be fans. So if you got one team that's really playing well, which will likely be the Sox, and the other one's not, where are people going to buy tickets when they finally do put fans in the stands?
Right, right.
And I think that's when the Cubs organization will realize, oh boy, we could be in trouble.
Well, let's switch over a little bit to the Chicago Bulls. You know, they started off pretty good, and they waned a little bit, but they're not doing too bad. They're only not even a game back from the eighth playoff spot back of the Charlotte Hornets. What do you think about these Bulls?
I really, really enjoy watching Billy Donovan coach this team. He knows how, when things are going well, he actually puts the right pieces in. But when things are going bad, like it did the other night against Detroit, when they're down by 25, and in the second half he goes, okay, the young players, you're going to sit to open the second half. And he went with his veterans like, you know, Thad Young and Garrett Temple and Denzel Valentine, along with the unbelievable scoring ability of Zach LaVine. And they were able to melt down that deficit and take the lead and win. It's really entertaining to watch the way he can coach this team. Zach LaVine deserves to be an all-star player. They will make the announcement next week. He is really playing lights out. There's a lot of good positives.
Good.
Now, they do have injury issues. They're not, you know, they're not going to be in the upper tier of the NBA. Mm-hmm. But if they make these big strides, it's going to look good for them.
Cheryl, before we only got a few more minutes, but mm-hmm. I do have to ask you this. You know, COVID infection rate is going down in Chicago. I think it's even below 4%. Mm-hmm. What is the city saying in allowing fans, even a little, to get back to the United Center to see the Blackhawks and the Chicago Bulls?
We're not hearing anything yet. Both the teams, both the Blackhawks and the Bulls have been asked about it, and nothing yet. They're hoping sometime in spring, you know, when they get towards the back end of their season, that they think that they could have fans. But they've been asking. They haven't been given the green light yet.
Are there any NBA teams right now that have fans in the stands?
Yes, the teams in the South.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Any red state has got it's got fans.
Well, you know,
in the
Cheryl, you know, it is interesting though that they want kids in schools and they're pushing for this, but not adults in an arena covered with their faces masked up and everything. I'm not sure what the issue is.
Well, there are going to be fans in Arizona and Florida for spring training.
Sure.
They're going to have, I think it's 25% can be filled.
Mm-hmm.
So they've already sold tickets for those games.
All right. Well, Cheryl Reistoud is a longtime sports veteran reporter for WBEZ. No, you're not old at all. But Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today again on Lakes Republic Radio on Off Mic.
Anytime, Michael.
Thank you. And that is all the time we have for today's show. I'd like to thank all my guests, the great Tom Skilling, Joe Gomestego, Steve Zaluski, and Cheryl Reistoud. You can catch this show again by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org and listening to it on a podcast. So me, Michael Puente, hope you stay warm. You can catch me tonight on Chicago Tonight on WTTW. I'll be a guest there tonight talking about some of the stories affecting Northwest Indiana and the Chicagoland area. But make sure you keep warm, stay safe, and it's one of those first Fridays for Lent. So get to those fish fries, even though there are no in-person dining. I don't believe so, but you can order that delicious fish, you know, at a church or somewhere near you. So have a safe weekend. Adios.